Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll talk about the cherry blossom hunter, English ornithologist and naturalist Collingwood Ingram, who gave up studying birds to devote his life to cataloging and preserving rare flowering cherry varieties, subject of the new book, The Sakura Obsession. But first, how many of you are twins? That many. Well, are you tired of being compared to your sibling? Maybe your parents dressed you alike, or people keep asking you who was born first, right? But twins, you know, have been a boon to science. So many twins studies examining the differences in their life stories, their ills, their diseases, the ultimate comparison. And now two famous twins, astronauts, have lent their lives to science. Specifically, what happens to your body after extended periods in the weightless, higher radiation levels of space? We've been asking this question since the beginning of human spaceflight, and there's still a lot we don't know. Astronauts have to exercise frequently to fight bone demineralization and muscle atrophy, fluids shift in their bodies in microgravity, and some even have vision changes. But in 2015, NASA undertook a more ambitious project to study the physiological and genetic changes of an identical twin pair. And those twins were astronauts Mark and Scott Kelly. Mark stayed on Earth. Scott spent nearly a full year on the International Space Station. And then in that time, they sent research teams samples of their blood, their urine. They took cognitive tests and put as much of their physiology under the microscope as possible to suss out what was going on in the space-born Scott cells that didn't happen to his brother.
There's stuff that you don't see. The researchers at some point will publish papers on, you know, for instance, how, you know, my DNA looked one way before flight and how his compared before flight, and then maybe how mine changed over time while I was here, where his, you know, in a certain area stayed the same.
That's Scott Kelly talking to us in 2015, early in the experiment. And now the data is in, published this week in the journal Science. And we're going to talk about the results, some of them surprising, with the leaders of two of the research teams on the NASA Twins study. Dr. Susan Bailey, professor of radiation, cancer biology, and oncology at Colorado State University. Welcome, Dr. Bailey.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And you're welcome. And Dr. Christopher Mason, Associate Professor of Physiology and Biophysics at Weill Cornell Medical Center here in New York. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let me ask you, Christopher, the study wrapped up. The data is in. It's a 90-page paper. Can you sum it up? what happened to Scott that didn't happen to Mark first?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a tome. There's a lot to read, but it is because we wanted to look at every molecule that we possibly could, and really every sort of physiological, molecular, genetic, really cognitive, even vasculature change. We wanted to map it all as best as we could. And we found that, you know, there's mostly good news because lots of things change, really thousands of genes change. There's many alterations to your DNA, to your proteins, to your whole body. But most of it goes back to normal once you get back to Earth. And some of the things that, you know, did change include, you know, really alterations to some of the telomeres, which Dr. Bailey will tell you about. And then also we saw gene expression, how what goes on and off in terms of how your DNA is basically transcribed and becomes active or deactivated. Some of those genes also changed and persisted.
So the early reports that said that the 7% of the DNA changed, that's not true.
Right. If 7% of his DNA changed, he'd be definitely a different species. So he did not come back heavily mutated, at least to be a different species. But there were some things that changed, fundamentally to his, basically how his DNA is packaged and really mapped out. And Dr. Bailey studied that in the telomeres.
Tell us what you found, Dr. Bailey.
Yes, well, we were really interested in looking at telomeres, or the ends of the chromosomes, and what they might tell us about aging and how that might be influenced by spaceflight. So we went into the study imagining that, in fact, all of the different stresses and exposures of spaceflight would really act to accelerate telomere loss. And so Scott's telomeres would be shorter than that Scott's telomeres would be shorter than Mark's after the year in space. But in fact, what we found was pretty much the opposite. During flight, Scott had many more long telomeres than he did beforehand. And then when he came back to Earth, within 48 hours, the closest samples that we had, his telomere length shortened dramatically. And so very rapid shift in telomere length. And then over the following months after he got back, his average telomere length did stabilize, but he still had many more short telomeres than he did when he started. So some really, you know, dramatic shifts in the telomere length that we really don't quite understand, but it's fascinating.
Hey, do the longer telomeres mean Scott Kelly was healthier in space?
No, and I don't think it really is the fountain of youth either. What exactly it is, I'm not real sure. I mean, they do live, you know, pretty healthy lifestyles. Their diets are very defined. They exercise a lot. They lose body mass, so caloric restriction. Scott lost about 15 pounds while he was up there. So, you know, things that we associate with healthy lifestyles here on Earth that influence telomere length. But even those things don't really make your telomeres longer. They just help you maintain telomere length. So we're still really scratching our heads on this one and imagining that it could be something like the radiation exposure, for example, or chronic exposure could be triggering some kind of a response that changes the cell populations themselves, and perhaps it's something like that.
Our number 844-724-8255 is if our listeners would like to get involved, and I'm sure they would. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Christopher, there are things we know happen to astronauts. Bone loss, I said, muscle atrophy, vision changes for some. Did any of this seem to show up in Scott's gene expression?
Yeah, very much so. So we saw a lot of the things you would expect right out of the gate. So you can see bone loss, essentially all the genes that are activated for osteoblasts or things that are actually helping to maintain and create bone density were really ramped up. And then also in his urine, you could see the calcium sort of disappearing. So you could see a struggle in his body to both build bones and muscle, and then also as it was for failing in a sense, it was being sort of degraded at the same time.
So is it confused? The body was confused?
Or it's a struggle. It's a Sisyphean struggle. You're pushing a rock up the mountain and just trying to make it so you don't fall down the mountain, really. You have to keep building the bone density as it's being sort of degraded by the lack of use. And so we could see that, like, you're looking at his blood. We took, you know, blood samples, dozens of points over. It was hundreds of samples at the end of the study, and we'd separate out the fractions of cells. So we'd look in the plasma of the blood, look in different kinds of immune cells, look at as much as we could from within the body, and it really serves as this molecular echo and a sort of a scan of what happens in the body. And yeah, very much so, you know, bone density, we saw really the building up of muscle and some of the atrophy at the same time. But really what was striking is also the immune system was ramped up. We saw some of the most significant changes were all in T-cell biology, or you think of your immune cells that help scavenge through the bloodstream, and also DNA damage, DNA repair. All of these genes were really ramped up, and more especially in the last 6 months of the mission than the first half. And so it seems
there was a sort of a switch after 6 months
that
turned on.
It seems as if it wasn't like he just got up there and adapted and was okay.
Right.
I mean, by some measures he was, but in terms of how many genes are activated and really sort of responding to spaceflight, it's a continual adaptation.
And so astronauts who are not up there for six longer months, they don't have the same sort of reaction.
No, some of the pathways we've seen and some of the genes that were activated have been observed in previous missions, but nothing to this degree and nothing at this scale.
Mm-hmm. Susan, you also looked at damage to the chromosomes themselves. It makes sense, right, with the higher radiation on the space station?
Yes, it sure does.
DNA might be...
Yeah, and it also fit very nicely with the work that Dr. Mason was just talking about with the DNA damage response. You know, they saw evidence of that in the gene expression, but we also saw it visually when we looked at chromosomes and how they rearranged. We know that those things are caused by radiation exposure. So we saw translocations, rearrangements between chromosomes, as well as inversions, rearrangements within a chromosome itself. And all of that was very, very consistent with space radiation exposure during flight in Scott.
So when Scott got back to Earth, did any of the damage get repaired? The DNA, well, move, the DNA movement move back.
Well, it doesn't really move back, but you do see, for example, you know, elevated frequencies of chromosome aberrations in flight of both mm-hmm. translocations and inversions. When he came back, the translocation frequency went down, mm-hmm. and again, that's because he loses those cells with translocations. They don't really survive, mm-hmm. So those cells drop out of the population. However, for the story on inversions was a little different. They did persist and were still elevated after flight. So again, just evidence of an ongoing kind of instability that continued even after he got back.
One quick question from the phones from Joe in Gainesville, Florida, before we go to the break. Hi, Joe.
Yes. I'm curious. The samples they took from Scott, urine, blood, etc., they were kept up there until they could be returned to Earth on a supply mission. Did the stay on the station change the samples once they were taken from Scott's body?
So, good question. I'll jump in quick first, I suppose. We did take two kinds of samples, some that were frozen and using a centrifuge on the space station that matched the speed and the angle on Earth. So we had some frozen samples, and they were kept frozen all the whole way down. But we also did what was called an ambient return collection. So Scott would draw blood and basically pop it into the Soyuz capsule. It'd be dropped back into Kazakhstan, would be picked up, repatriated, brought back to Houston. That's a verb I've never used till this study, is repatriated a sample, and then sorted cells. And we needed live cells for some of the work that Dr. Bailey wanted to do, and also a way to sort purified cells. We did as best as we could to make sure we could get rid of any batch effects, and we have two kinds of collection.
Susan, any question before we have to go for the break?
No, I'd just add to that yes, our samples also came back to us ambient on the Soyuz and then jetted back to Johnson Space Center, and we did our processing and analysis at Johnson Space Center.
All within 38 hours, they come back to Earth.
Yeah, it's great. Amazing.
Quickest repatriation ever.
That's right.
Okay. Yes, that's right. Now you know why the paper was so long.
We will take a break and talk lots more with Susan Bailey of Colorado State University and Christopher Mason of Weill Cornell Medicine right here in New York. Our number 844-724-8255. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about what life in space, microgravity, radiation, confined spaces, and more does to your cells and even the DNA in your cells. The Ultimate Twins Study, astronauts Scott and Mark Kelly. That study was published this week in Science. My guests are Dr. Susan Bailey of Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Dr. Christopher Mason of Weill Cornell Medical Center here in New York City. Our number 844-724-8255. Getting back to the bottom line on all of this, let me repeat for our listeners who are joining us now. Christopher, did astronaut Kelly have any long-lasting Scott, did he have any long-lasting effects from this? Do we know yet?
So most of it reverted back to normal, as we described a little bit before. But there were some things that did persist. And so we looked at a lot of genes that changed, adapt to environments as they do here on Earth. And in space, we saw, you know, thousands and thousands of genes change. And almost all of them went back to normal. But about 800 of them were still looked as if he was still in space, even 6 months later. And earlier this week, we were chatting with Scott a bit more. And he said, you know, he really felt like he was a little bit off, even out until 8 or 9 months after he got back to Earth. So I think there was a continual adaptation that took at least 6 months for him to sort of revert back to normal, at least in terms of the gene expression data. Mm-hmm. And so we see, you know, but other things change really rapidly. So if you look, for example, in his blood, we saw some measures increased 4,000% as soon as he landed, that are with inflammation markers, but almost all those went back, you know, away within a couple of days. Mm-hmm. And same with the telomeres, as we've heard from Dr. Bailey.
Susan, Dr. Bailey, what do we need to know more about before we allow people to go to you know, to Mars, where they're going to be in space a lot longer than a year, right?
Yes. Well, I certainly would like to know a lot more about why these changes and shifts in telomere length dynamics are occurring. I think if we understood why they were happening, we could know what to do about it, or if there's any real concern there as astronauts spend longer and longer periods of time in space. I do think that it alerts us to the fact as well when they come back that they do have a lot more short telomeres, which can put them at increased risk of aging and some of the diseases that go along with aging, like cardiovascular disease and some cancers.
Tell us why the telomeres are so interesting to you. What do they do?
They're fascinating because they are the ends of our chromosomes, and that really kind of like the end of a shoestring, perhaps, that you could think of, that it protects the end from fraying, from damage, and it's short. They shorten as we get older because they shorten with cell division, but they also shorten with all kinds of stress and exposures to things like radiation, or at least that's what we think on Earth. That's what we see. So they can be a very informative biomarker of how quickly or how well a person is aging, as well as if there are a lot of short telomeres, can also be very indicative or associated with some of the diseases that we associate with aging, like cardiovascular disease.
Which do you think, I'll ask both of you, let me begin with you, Chris, which was the greater hazard? Radiation or microgravity or weightlessness?
Well, I think we can see evidence of both, definitely, in terms of what we know for human biology or what we looked at in mouse samples that have been sent as an analog into the space station. And from what we can tell, at least from the gene expression data, is like how much of your genome, of all of the genes in your cells are adapting. You know, we see a lot more response to radiation, but frankly, we know those networks of biology much better than we know, like, what is the microgravity or a reduced gravity response to cells. We do see both, but I think the one that's still active and seems to be the most active from what we can tell is really the radiation, because it propagates to all parts of cells. And it may even, you know, one of the things that happened after the mission is cognitive sort of metrics were worse off 6 months later.
That didn't get better.
And so that's another thing that's on the list of things that are not necessarily bad, but they're just not the direction that you'd want them to be.
But they were permanent as far as they could test 6 months out.
6 months out, right.
He couldn't think as quickly, or
by speed and accuracy. The work from Matthias Bosner's group that really showed that he really, for these 10 different cognitive tests, you know, solving puzzles, shape recognition, some quick math, he was not as good as he was when he's even in space.
Susan, what's that going to mean for somebody who gets to Mars and has lost his cognitive, or at least some of his abilities?
Well, that's not going to be very good now, is it? So, yeah, I mean, it is definitely a concern, and, you know, something that we really need to figure out. But I would certainly agree that, you know, I think radiation exposure is by far the greatest risk, and cognitive decline has been associated with radiation exposure, particularly to space radiation. So I think, again, you know, radiation is really going to be the thing that we need to learn how to deal with, and I think technology is going to have to be the thing that helps us there. You know, either get them there quicker or figure out some better shielding that they can take with them. But I think most of the health effects or the damaging things that we saw could be explained by radiation exposure.
You know, Scott in his book and in testimony talked about how difficult it was the first few weeks. Yeah. I mean, he just couldn't walk, couldn't function.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to go to another planet and you can't walk off the spaceship or get off of it or function for a while.
Yeah, I mean, his legs swelled up. He really felt like they turned into balloons, he said. He felt like he needed to go to the emergency room. Even just the simple weight of clothing on his arm, since he hadn't felt it in a year, his arms broke out into a rash. And we can actually see that in the blood. The inflammation markers were sky high, like I said, sometimes several thousand percent higher than what they were before the mission or even during the mission. So, you know, it's interesting. Some things change as soon as you get to space. You can see cortisol levels will spike up because your body's thinking, well, I'm in space, you know, so it's surprising. But then they'll sort of settle down, and Scott in general is as cool as a cucumber. But, you know, the body didn't react well to gravity.
Do we know, I mean, the Soviets have had their own cosmonauts in space. I mean, have they shared data with us?
There was another Russian cosmonaut that was up for a year, but not all of the data has been shared, or not that much of it, actually, that we've seen and that I know exists. So that's still being negotiated.
I see. They were still talking to them.
You know, I tried to call Putin last night, but he didn't pick up my call.
So where do we go from here? I mean, what would you recommend that we do?
Well,
let me ask Susan first, and then Christopher, you can answer. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that, you know, there's certainly the twin study represents by far the most comprehensive study that's ever been done on the response of the human body to spaceflight. And it, as such, it's really a landmark, and it sets the baseline for going forward. You know, we now know a lot more about the questions to ask. We know more about the health effects to keep to monitor when our astronauts come back. So I think in that sense, it's been a huge step forward, and really does set the bar and will help us as we go, mm-hmm. you know, into future studies and get additional astronauts.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. we only have N equals one now, mm-hmm. right?
And so, mm-hmm. it's N of one, but over hundreds of time points. So we know a lot about yeah. how things changed over time. But for sure, the most important goal is to do things with more greater numbers of samples. There's only 569 people that have ever left Earth and gone to 100 kilometers. So the sample size can't get that big yet. But we, you know, I think every cosmonaut, astronaut, every commercial space flight that goes up, we now know what to look for. And I think it's helpful for humanity to think more about what happens to other people of different ages and genders.
Well, you know, the president has talked about going back to the moon.
Yeah, 2024.
Forget about Mars right. for now. I mean, the moon has even less gravity than Mars does.
Yeah, 1/6. And so so one good thing is all the swelling and pain of returning to gravity. You know, even though space flight's hard, gravity is much harder on the body from everything that we've observed. But, you know, the moon is 1/6 and Mars is 36% of the gravity of Earth. So even
and the radiation exposure there?
It is higher.
Yeah. Much higher.
Yeah, so
because they're outside of the protection yeah. of the Earth.
The Van Allen belt.
The Van Allen belt's atmosphere, all those things that protect us here, you know, they don't have on the moon or certainly not at Mars.
So you'd want to solve that problem before 5 years. And with that happy news, let me wind up and say thank you very much, Dr. Susan Bailey, professor of radiation cancer biology and oncology, Colorado State University in Fort Collins, and Christopher Mason, associate professor of physiology and biophysics at Weill Cornell Medical Center here in New York.
Thank you.
Thank you both for taking
Thank
time
you
to be
so
with
much.
Us today.
Pleasure.
As a Sci-Fry listener, you've been asked numerous times to put on your citizen science cap and do real research, meaningful stuff. And today you've got a chance to help solve a question about Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's, as you know, is a complicated disease. It can affect a person's brain and behavior in many different ways. There isn't one definition of the disease, but about 30% of people with Alzheimer's experience a decrease in blood flow to their brains caused by white blood cells clumping up in the vessels. And researchers at Cornell University have found that this blockage can happen in the tiniest blood vessels in the brain, of course, the capillaries. And they're trying to figure out why this happens and what are the effects. And to do that, they have to go through hundreds of thousands of images of hair-like capillaries, and that could take years for one scientist. That's why they're turning to the power of the crowd. They've created a game called Stall Catchers, and the aim is to go through 1 year's worth of data in a one-day megathon, as they call it. And here to tell us more are Chris Schaffer, who is part of that Cornell research team, associate professor of biomedical engineering there, and Pietro Michelucci, who's a project lead for Stall Catchers and director of the Human Computation Institute based out of Ithaca, New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So yes, thanks.
Chris, let's talk about your work is in mice. How much do we know about why Alzheimer's affects the blood flow in the brain?
So in mice that have been genetically engineered to get Alzheimer's disease, we found that this roughly 30% decrease in brain blood flow that's associated with Alzheimer's is caused by a certain class of white blood cells that are adhered and stuck inside individual capillary segments. When we gave a drug that interfered with the adhesion of those white blood cells, those stalled capillaries started flowing again. And after that happened, blood flow in the brain improved by about 30%, so kind of recovering the deficit that those Alzheimer's disease mice had relative to non-Alzheimer's disease mice.
Do we know why the white blood cells clump in the vessels of the Alzheimer's patients?
So again, in Alzheimer's disease mice, but our thinking is that that's due to inflammation in the brain caused by the aggregates of this small peptide called amyloid beta, which is the thing that aggregates into the plaques that are the kind of classic pathological hallmark of Alzheimer's disease. So those aggregates of amyloid beta, one of the things they do is they just drive kind of a general brain inflammation. And one of the things that happens in inflamed tissue is there's an increase in the number of proteins along the cells that line the blood vessel walls, the endothelial cells. There's an increase in proteins that white blood cells will stick to when they see them.
Gotcha.
And when you have a cut or infection or something like that, those white blood cells crawl into the tissue and can, you know, do, you know, kill pathogens, help repair tissue, things like that. But it looks like in the case of Alzheimer's disease, it's a low level of inflammation. It's just causing these white blood cells to stick and block blood flow in individual capillary segments, and they don't seem to be doing something good.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Pietro, we have big supercomputers, and we have neural nets and AI that can analyze tons of data. Why are you turning to people for this project? What can they do better?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. You know, AI is doing amazing things today, in some part, that's due to advances in AI technology, but in large part, it's just due to having faster computers. And having even the fastest calculator doesn't make it more than a calculator. It's how it thinks. And humans still think in ways that AI cannot. And so when I met Chris and we started talking about the kind of analysis that needed to be done on his Alzheimer's data sets, you know, the first question was, well, have you tried using machine learning and various forms of AI to do this? And he said, yeah, we have. It's just not quite good enough. It's about 85% accurate, and we need 99.
So people are just better at this, is what you're saying.
Well, yeah, I think that's exactly right. We still have an edge on the machines. And one reason for that is that most of the AI approaches today are based on pattern recognition. And that means the answer has to be in the pixels. It has to be in the picture you're looking at. And sometimes the picture isn't enough. It takes a real-world context to understand what's going on.
That's something people can do. Okay, so if people are interested, our audience is interested, how do they sign up for this?
Yeah, absolutely. So tomorrow is National Citizen Science Day, and we partnered with SciStarter to put on a nationwide event. And the featured citizen science project is Stall Catchers, and it's called the Megathon. So you go to megathon.us, and you register there. And then between the hours of 10:30 and 12:30 tomorrow morning Pacific time, and I guess if you're on the East Coast, add 3 hours to that. Just tune in to our live stream and play the game during that time, and you will be analyzing data next to the scientists. You're not a subject in the experiment. You're a scientist participating in the analysis.
Well, this sounds like a very important experiment, or analysis. What if you're afraid of making a mistake and, you know, I'm just a person?
Right. And so, you know, this is when we developed the platform to pull in information from the crowd. This was one of our first concerns and there's a fair amount of skepticism in the scientific community about how much can you trust scientific analysis generated by members of the general public. And so we use this approach called wisdom of crowds. And that means that we'll show the same tiny capillary vessel to several different people, and then we'll combine their answers together in a sensible way. So when you get one wrong, then three other people are getting it right. And in the end, we validated the platform to ensure that we're meeting Cornell's stringent data quality requirements, no matter whether you make a mistake or not.
All right, let me repeat how people can sign up. You can sign up for the Stall Catchers Megathon. It's happening this Saturday. You can see a list of citizen science projects. It's up on our website at sciencefriday.com/catchers. And how many people are we looking for?
Well, we're aiming for 100,000 people.
Okay, we're going to melt your server. we have done that before with other. That's a good thing, I think. So
absolutely.
We'll try to get you enough people. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Pietro Micolucci, who is a project lead for Stallcatchers and director of the Human Computation Institute based in Ithaca, and Chris Schaefer, associate professor of biomedical engineering at Cornell University in Ithaca. And of course, you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com/catchers, where you can help help real scientists do, you know, an analysis of their data. We've had some great luck with this. Lots of people get involved. I'll give you that website again. It's sciencefriday.com/catchers for a Citizen Science Project of the Month. We'll be right back after this break. We're going to talk about the history of the cherry blossom. Oh, the cherry blossom trees in Japan. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's cherry blossom season across the country. The famous tidal basin in Washington, D.C., of course, which has already hit its peak. And here in New York, those pink and white clouds of flowers are, well, we're getting ready for them to just about pop here. And our famous blooms, they have an interesting and little-known backstory, too. Listen to this. Japan sent the first shipment of 2,000 cherry trees to the U.S. in 1909 as a sign of gratitude to America. But that shipment isn't what you see blooming today, because it was infested with insects and the whole thing was incinerated. Now, a second shipment of saplings destined for New York, that sank on the steamer en route. So it wasn't until a full 3 years later that the first Japanese cherry trees arrived in New York and Washington safe from insects and shipwrecks. And that's just one of the many interesting tales in the Sakura Obsession, a book about the cultural history of cherry blossoms in Japan and around the world, and about a really interesting character, English ornithologist and naturalist Collingwood Cherry Ingram, who devoted his life to cataloging and preserving these blooms. And boy, did he have opinions about cherry varieties. But we'll get into that. I want to introduce the author. Naoko Abe is a former journalist from Japan's Mainichi newspaper and the author of The Sakura Obsession, the incredible story of the plant hunter who saved Japan's cherry blossoms. We have an excerpt up on our website, and we have some interesting cherry photos for you at sciencefriday.com/cherry. Naoko, welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah. Hello. Thank you.
Let me get the obvious question out of the way about, are you related to the Prime Minister of Japan at all?
No, not at all.
Okay. Because our listener is going to want to know that, but Abe is a very common name in Japan.
Yeah, pretty common, yes. Right,
let's talk about Ingram. He didn't start out as a cherry enthusiast, did he? You write that his first scientific endeavor was ornithology, studying birds.
Yes.
What happened?
Basically, he got fed up with birds.
That's pretty simple.
Well, yeah. He was a true naturalist, and so he was very much interested in nature. He grew up in the nature, and he never went to school. But it was the First World War that he went, which changed his views on life. So he saw lots of, you know, deaths, and it really changed his views on life. So when he came back from the war, well, he didn't fight. He went as a compass adjuster, but he saw lots of deaths and dark side of the human lives. And so so when he came back to England from the war, he wanted something new. He wanted to start. He was having kind of a crisis, midlife crisis. Midlife crisis.
Yeah.
So he wanted a new start. So he, and also he was tired of ornithology. He thought there were too many ornithologists, and so he bought a new house with his wife and four children to live in, mm-hmm. in Kent, big house. But he didn't have a garden, so he thought he bought massive amount of massive acres of land, but so he thought, oh, maybe this is my new area that I can build a new garden of dreams. So he thought he would become a plantsman instead of Yeah, ornithology.
But he chose cherries?
He chose cherry because there were two massive cherry trees which, in the new house, which right. were kind of rarity back then. It was in 1919. They were not popular in Europe at all. So,
well, in Europe, Europe people expected the cherry trees to produce cherries. And
these
did not produce cherries.
No,
right?
They were ornamental Japanese cherries, which were very rare back then. People didn't care about cherries who didn't produce, right. which didn't produce cherries. So anyway, that caught those two big tree cherry trees caught his attention, mm. and he thought. And then the following spring, they were smothered with pink blossoms, which were really beautiful. And he thought, this is a virgin territory that you know no one explored before. So maybe I can be an expert of cherry blossom. He was very passionate and a very passionate man and very ambitious. So he thought he could be an expert. So he starts collecting different varieties of cherry blossoms. So within 6 years, he had a massive cherry orchard in his garden. He collected them and planted them in his garden and created a beautiful. And within 6 years, he was a cherry expert, sort of, and he was a believer of diversity and variety. So it was very important for him to have as many varieties of cherry trees as possible, which he did collect.
Right. Right. Yeah. And did he go to Japan and study the cherry trees over there?
Yeah, he went to Japan 3 times in all. And the third trip, which was 1926, he dedicated that trip to collecting rare right. varieties of cherry blossoms because he thought he collected as many cherry varieties as possible based in Kent, in England. So now he thought, you know, I need to go to Japan again, right. you know, for collecting rare varieties.
But he had he had very strong opinions about which kinds of cherry varieties, didn't he? I mean, like the Kanzen, for example, which he thought was obscene.
Yes, exactly.
He really had strong opinions about his cherry tree.
He thought Kanzen was, it's a dark pink, very showy kind right. of blossoms. He thought it was too showy, and he called it like a prostitute. Sorry. He thought it was too blousy, and he preferred simple single petal cherries, like mountain cherry.
Proper cherry. Very proper.
Very simple, but you know, delicate and you right. know, quiet beauty, and so he disliked Kanzen, but he loved many other varieties. Mm-hmm. And
he thought of cherry trees like people.
Exactly.
He thought of them as
they were like his children.
Yeah.
And he was talking to them, and he was really loving each variety. He was often asked by other people or by media to write about cherries and which varieties do you like best, and he would often say it's like asking a mother which child do you right. do you prefer right. Is your favorite. So it was difficult.
Well, while he was in Japan, he was invited by business and government leaders to give a speech mm-hmm. about cherries, and he gave them a warning. Right?
Yes. He had high hopes in his 1926 cherry hunting trip. But as soon as he got to Japan, he was deeply disappointed because he found out that, at that time, especially Tokyo and Yokohama area, Kanto area, was trying to recover from the great Kanto earthquake, which destroyed everything in that area. And so all he saw was huge Western building, concrete buildings, and there was no nature. Mm. So he was deeply, he doesn't like civilization. he loves nature. So, and then at the same time, he discovered that the Japanese people no longer cared about cherry varieties, which had been developed over the past 2,000 years.
Wow.
Over 1,000 years. And so he was deeply disappointed because he didn't know that. So he gave a warning say, to the top, top leaders of government officials or politicians or royalty or business leaders. It was really the cream of the establishment gathering. And he said, you must treasure the past. You must treasure all these beautiful cherry varieties, which are in serious danger of extinction. In fact, quite a few of them had gone extinct by the time he went.
So he saw that as his mission then, to help save cherry varieties in Japan.
Exactly. He thought that the, you know, he said in his speech to the meeting that, you know, unless you did something about this crisis, you would have lost permanently. In 50 years, you've lost all the cherry varieties. You would have to go to America or Europe or to the UK to find the varieties.
Did they listen to him for this warning? Did they heed the warning?
I think, I'm sure some did, the naturalists, but they were business leaders. And then the country was focused on modernization, industrialization.
And familiar story.
They were the leaders of that, you know, trend movement. So, unfortunately, he gave a stark warning, but I think it fell on deaf ears.
So he took it upon himself.
He did.
He did to save
the extraordinary thing about him is that he decided to save and preserve them himself in his Kent garden.
Is that right? Wow. Yes. And you write in the book about a transformation of Japan's cherry trees, the planting of a single species, the Yoshino cherry, instead of a wide variety of species. And that's what we see in the Potomac. The Potomac cherry is the Yoshino.
That's right, yeah.
And so you've now, the word I'm going to use, vanilla-ized. You've taken one species and made it above everything else. And then people don't start looking at the other beautiful varieties of the plant.
And what was happening in Japan was that Yoshino cherry was developed. It's kind of a young variety, which was developed at the end of the 19th century compared to other varieties which had thousands of years.
So you've overshadowed all those traditional varieties.
Yeah. What was happening was that the new government, the Japanese new government, you know, which was focused on westernization, industrial, and modernizing the country, was looking for a new symbol, kind of new symbol of new Japan, and this cherry fitted that purpose because they were beautiful and they grew fast and they were inexpensive to propagate and easy to propagate, and
Perfect. So.
Very quickly, they attracted people's attention and the authorities' attention that it was very convenient to plant. And very quickly, the mass production system was set up. And so this single variety was planted en masse in thousands. Every time Japan won a major war, whether it was with China or with Russia or the enthronement of a new emperor, Emperor Taisho and Emperor Showa, Hirohito, this variety was planted en masse, you know, like 2,000, 3,000 all over Japan. So, in essence, it took over the old varieties which had thrived over centuries.
That's too bad.
Yeah, so they were forgotten. People still loved the cherry blossoms, but the single variety.
Yeah, that's why we see them in the Potomac. I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Talking with Naoka Abe about her book, The Sakura Obsession, The Incredible Story of the Plant Hunter Who Saved Japan's Cherry Blossoms. I want to ask you to read a passage in the book because it was so fitting. It was before environmentalism became a mainstream idea. Ingram was talking about these issues, modernism, as you say, progress, and so on, coming at the cost of the natural world. And you have a passage to read us that reflects his thinking on that. Could you read that for us?
Yeah. He said, "Progress, improvement, development, call it what you like, is rapidly reaching even the remotest corners of the globe. Wherever modern man comes into contact with nature, he leaves a disfiguring mark. As his members as his numbers multiply, so the fundamental beauty of the universe decreases. The passing of beauty and romance from the world is, to me, a source of endless regret. When the Victoria Falls have been harnessed and Spitsbergen turned into a teeming coal field, it will be time to think of another planet.
Wow.
That's what he said over 90 years ago, which is very relevant to modern times.
Like a prophet.
Mm.
He could see that happening. He says, if this is going to happen to my cherry blossoms, we're going to have one variety for everybody, and we don't care about all the other details, and this could happen to the rest of the environment around the world.
Yeah.
Are you going to go out and see the cherry blossoms here?
In the States?
In the States?
Oh, yeah, yesterday.
Where were you?
Yes, I went to Brooklyn Botanic Garden,
right.
And I saw Collingwood Ingram's creation, this variety called Okame. It was in beautiful blossom. It's his creation. He hybridized.
Is that right?
Yeah.
How
did it get to Brooklyn?
It's interesting to look into that.
Well, that's
a beautiful garden there.
Yes. And quite a few of his cherry trees in his Kent garden came over here to, you know, to the Washington's National Arboretum.
Right.
Like whether it was Taihaku, Great White Cherry, or Hokusai, is, you know, named after the great woodprinter, which was the first cherry tree which attracted his attention to become a cherry expert. So Hokusai and,
If you want to find them, you can see them all around the country, his cherry trees.
In the States?
In the States,
That's
fascinating.
Yeah.
Thank you for this book. It's a wonderful book. I'm a historian of science. I love to read these books, and you've done a wonderful job in there. We don't have enough time to get into all the details, but it was
It
was very nice of you to come by and share it with us.
Thank you.
And Naoko Abe is author of The Sakura Obsession, The Incredible Story of the Plant Hunter Who Saved Japan's Cherry Blossoms. A really interesting tale. You would have never thought about this. And as you go out and look at the blossoms blossoming, you can go to our website and see some of the cherry photos we have up there at sciencefriday.com/cherry. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. And if you missed any part of the program, you'd like to hear it again, you can subscribe to our podcast. You have a speaker. You can ask it to play Science Friday. It's whenever you want to. Every day now is Science Friday. And we go to our website. We have all kinds of educational materials. We have educational videos. A lot of you bet you don't even know how many videos we have up there on our website, science-related, education-related. They're all up there for you to use in school or just to surf through them and appreciate them. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.